On the phone with me right now on Nolan Radio is Drew Reiber with his top 10 best movies of 2004 and his top 5 worst. Drew, what do you got?
I just thought that this year was pretty poor overall for good films, but towards the end of the year, all of the major studios started releasing whatever they thought was their best because they want to get into the Oscars. So things have kind of turned around in the last season. I would say that, you know, some of you are probably going to think I'm insane for a few of my my top 10, but again, it wasn't really a stellar year.
I believe you said before that you thought 2003 was actually a stronger year than 2004.
And I believe 2005 will be a stronger year than both of these years combined.
I actually agree. Yeah, we'll talk about that later, but let's do your top 10, best of 2004.
I'll do 10 to 1. So.
Oh, 10 to 1 is fine.
Finding Neverland, I thought it was a very simple, you know, film about imagination, fairy tales, and it's not like, you know, this unbelievably different film that something we've never seen before, but I thought it was heartwarming and, you know, really good performances. One of the best child performances I've seen in a long time.
One of Johnny Depp's strongest, I heard?
It's definitely strong. I mean, you know, it's also restrained, and so he shows that he can play a human being, which a lot of people probably after a while are beginning to doubt. But overall, it really gives you that sense of renewed imagination, that kind of imagination you had as a child, and trying to rekindle that inside you. And I think the film really, really shined in that way.
All right.
And Ocean's 12, I think the film is kind of being misunderstood. A lot of people expected Ocean's 11 Part 2, and instead they got a completely different film. I think that they try to take what we all know and our kind of love or hate for the celebrities in these films and kind of reflect on that and let us kind of, I don't know, make fun of it, not necessarily as a parody, but just be aware that we're watching a movie and these are movie characters. But it was done too subtle and far too late because people were going to this movie expecting a straight little, you know, heist film, and they got something that was very kooky and unorthodox.
But enjoyable, an enjoyable ride, obviously.
I found it very enjoyable, but I'm afraid that, you know, a lot of people are going to get alienated by it, and overall there's probably going to be a bit of a drop-off towards the end of the year for this film. But I think people should definitely give it at least a shot.
All right, so that's number 9.
Seed of Chucky, one of the more original horror films I've seen in a while, since Wes Craven did New Nightmare in the mid-90s. We've been on this sort of reflexive slasher subgenre where we reflect on the fact that there are movies within movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they did a very good job of satirizing, you know, social spending or social problems in families and such, gender identity, surprisingly using and imaginative for a goofy little film. It's a different Bride of Chucky as Bride of Chucky was the rest of the series, and very John Waters inspired. I definitely think people should give it a shot.
I'm sorry, your phone dropped out for just a second. It's compared to what series?
The Bride of Chucky series. I'm sorry, got me all mixed up. I was saying that it's different to Bride of Chucky. That Bride of Chucky was different from the rest of the Child's Play series.
Oh, Child's Play. Okay.
Yeah, but I think people should definitely give it a shot when it comes to home video if they like black comedy.
Okay, stay real close to the phone. Number 7?
The Aviator, which I know, like most people, haven't seen yet. It comes out Friday in like 17 cities and comes out Christmas Day everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably going to be the Oscar pick of the year. It glamorizes Hollywood and aviation, the Silver Age of aviation, and great performances by Cate Blanchett, Leonardo DiCaprio, and Martin Scorsese really did a terrific job with a decent screenplay.
Okay.
Shaun of the Dead, just real wonderful homage to George Romero's horror films.
I like that very much too, yeah.
Very much its own film, though. I think that it was also slightly Sam Raimi-inspired. And aside from maybe like a little bit of a drag towards the end, I just found it pound for pound pretty good stuff. Spider-Man 2, easily one of the best comic book movies ever made. Still a little derivative of the Superman films, but Raimi's really mastered his balance of his more avant-garde camera techniques with that of mainstream filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he's definitely one of the best filmmakers out there today.
Excellent. Yeah, I liked it very much, too, and I agree that it's one of the best comic movies ever made.
Fahrenheit 9/11, it failed in what it was trying to do, get done. But it was a real event, and it's really cool that this...
I'm not so sure it failed. It failed to get George W. out of office, but it certainly brought awareness to a lot of people about a lot of behind the scenes of the Bush administration. And it made people ask the right questions, and it definitely caused a lot of controversy.
Yeah, but as a piece of propaganda, its goal was not met, which is unfortunate in my opinion, you know, but I'm just saying, regardless of your opinion, I do believe it kind of fell short of where they were hoping it would impact politics.
Propaganda or documentary?
It's both. I mean, you know, anybody who thinks that a documentary is pure realism is out of their mind. I mean, it's a camera, you're aiming, you're shooting, you're editing. I mean, if anything, it's woken up audiences to the idea that documentary is not anywhere near as real as they think it is. Also with that and Super Size Me, I think this has been a great year to kind of realize that documentaries can be as cool as movies.
Okay.
Dogville, a little scene film with Nicole Kidman, directed by Lars von Trier, really screwed up kind of take on American folktale. It was actually narrated by John Hurt, also known as the storyteller from the Jim Henson produced series.
Mm-hmm.
Very long, but I found rewarding if you like that angry straw dogs, peck and claw kind of social criticism.
Mm-hmm.
And anger. I tried to liken it to what George Lucas was trying to do with Episode One, but if you just delete all the special effects, you know, would you really be able to believe that these people are pantomiming in a world from the, you know,
mm-hmm.
from different, you know, or different worlds? And I think it completely succeeded in creating in your mind, using your imagination to create a whole town out of a handful of lines on the ground and props. The second best film I saw this year, I think a lot of people would agree on, was Pixar's The Incredibles.
Oh yes, absolutely.
Which, a lot of people probably haven't picked up yet, was somewhat of a sly adaptation of Alan Moore's Watchmen.
Mixed with just a little bit of Fantastic Four.
Absolutely, and a little bit of James Bond.
And a little bit of James Bond, yeah, right down to the 5/4 spy music, right? The little touch of Mission Impossible in there, yeah.
Well, stylization for an animated film was... I think shocking. I wasn't prepared for that, and I also wasn't prepared for how much camera work and focus pulling that was going on, you know, rack focusing inside of an animated film.
The photorealism, I should say, of many of the scenes looked to be almost really intercuttable with a live-action movie. They just don't really care about keeping it all that cartoony anymore. It's like if it's cartoony, fine. If it's not cartoony, fine. Or maybe that was the whole point, is that it doesn't matter. This is all real in their universe.
Absolutely. I think that that because it never remains static, they're just always moving, and they're always creating these ideas of these sort of realistic characters that work for children and adults, but also in its camera movement that you, I really believe you forget after a while that you're watching an animated feature.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And another thing that people are beginning to wonder is there any way that you can promote the auteur theory with animated features now? Because despite the amount of people that worked on this, it was written and directed by one man, and they can actually find parallels between this and his earlier work, The Iron Giant. So that's pretty neat.
Just for our audience, that man was?
Oh, Brad Bird.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, but I was going to say the best film I've seen this year, which I just saw the other day, I believe is The Life Aquatic. And I know
the number one film of the year.
Number one film of the year, yeah. I mean, it took me about 3 or 4 hours after I saw the film to really process it all. I mean, you know, Dogville was very original, but it was very draining and too long. Incredibles was awesome, but it was also very derivative of many other sources. I mean, it did it very well. But The Life Aquatic, I just felt, was one of the most original visions I've seen in a very long time. It was by far Wes Anderson's best film. Stellar performances from the cast, except for Owen Wilson, but, you know, I think that anytime you go see a movie with Owen Wilson, you know what you're going to get. I do believe that the critics and a lot of people are jumping to conclusions about what this movie means and what Wes Anderson's doing and compared to the rest of his filmography. This movie really stands on its own and needs to be seen as such.
Without giving too much away to the audience, the controversy revolves around how it's shot and that it's kind of a movie within a movie.
No, I really think that the controversy revolves around a lot of different elements, whether they're thematic or, you know, performances, and people don't exactly know how it all goes together. They try to figure out what kind of movie it is, or why did you use this stop motion? Why did you shoot it like this? Or what are you trying to say? Why are you being so obnoxious? Mm-hmm. And typically, when you don't understand why a movie does something, you figure that they just threw something at you, hoping it would land and entertain you. But I think the movie is a lot more complex than that. You really have to take all of it into you know, just really think about it. You know, maybe not just even write it off on the first time you see it. Maybe go see it twice. In its own way, I know this is a very strange comparison. It's kind of like Mulholland Drive by David Lynch, in that it's going to take multiple viewings for you to sort of throw all the pieces together, and you're going to have to look at this movie from a lot of different directions. But please don't go into this movie expecting Royal Tenenbaums or Rushmore. This is not a transparent ensemble piece. This is a movie about Steve Zissou and Bill Murray's character, and just try to relate everything that you find in this movie to him, and I think that you'll find it an enjoyable experience.
All right, fantastic. Thanks a lot. Now we'll brace ourselves while you lay on us the five top worst movies of 2004, starting with number five.
Dawn of the Dead. I really thought that beyond having no message, it also had no story, and it was really just, oh my God, zombies. Oh God, a couple people died. Let's shoot them. Oh my God, some more of us died. We're on an island. And it felt like I was watching somebody else play a video game, badly made video game.
Like we were talking slightly before the program, the first 10 minutes is encouraging with all the action-filled aerial shots. But then it quickly devolved to just being mall-centric without really touching on the points that Romero was trying to make in the original movie.
Well, I think it's a classic example of where you're trying too hard to be like another movie that you don't really want to be like to begin with. So there were a lot of very interesting ideas that were in the film they could have explored and they never bothered following it up, which is a shame.
Number four.
Coffee and Cigarettes.
Yeah, that's one I've never even heard of until you brought it up. Go ahead.
It was an anthology of short pieces that Jim Jarmusch directed that all involved people drinking coffee or smoking cigarettes. And if you really believe there's anything more than that, well, kudos to you. I don't care. It really was a very painful and pretentious experience. I hope that I might find the ability to bury it all in my memory.
Was that in wide release, or is that just at art houses, or what?
It did a limited release by MGM Studios, and it's now on DVD. So, if you all want to fight me on that, go and buy it and have a really good time.
Number three.
Punisher. I know that you guys
the
are
The notorious
all,
Punisher.
You know, I mean, it brought a lot of money to this town, you know, to Tampa, and thanks. You know, thanks, and don't come back, please. It was excruciating. It made me appreciate the original way more than I ever thought I would. I mean, I know that I've likened the. It made me. I think I told you it was cliched, but it really felt like, you know, it was Citizen Kane after seeing the remake. They didn't understand or care who the Punisher was as a comic book character. They really just.
If one was a fan of the comic book character, one was pretty much going to hate this. But I thought, as an action movie that had nothing to do with the comic, I thought it was okay, and it showed Tampa in a definitely flattering light. But it was a very hated movie. Yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely. Tampa was shot well. I just didn't appreciate the overabundance of having to name everything Tampa something. You know, let's go to the Tampa golf course. Let's go to the Tampa train station. You know, you don't have to mention Tampa every 45 seconds to get a tax break.
Well, it's a way of a fake getting back for a cop and a half where it was shot in Tampa, and they seemed to want to hide that fact during the movie.
Well, I also believe that it really actually wasn't a good film, because even if you take it away from being about the Punisher, which is what it was supposed to be, it was a very shoddy knockoff of movies like El Mariachi or Desperado and Mad Max and William Friedkin's French Connection. I thought that it just, like, the director just didn't seem to know what made those other films work. He just took what he thought would somehow, once he shot it, it would just all come together. I really couldn't make heads or tails of the film for most of it.
Is there going to be a Punisher 2?
Yeah, but it's not going to be shot in Tampa, South Africa, I believe. With Michael Keaton as Jigsaw.
Are we up to number 2?
Catwoman.
Catwoman. Oh, boy, did that suck.
Wow. I made the right choice, and it was my first drive-in experience. And I always wanted to see a bad movie at a drive-in, and wow, I was not disappointed.
You hit a home run with that one.
Yeah, it's...
Basically, you could describe it as a two-hour-long music video.
Whatever reason, I think the editor might have hit his or her head before cutting the film, because no matter, even if it was a nice little conversation at a desk, you would cut between each person's face every 1.5 seconds.
Like a music video, right, just constantly. It interrupted the narrative, it was so distracting.
I'm telling you, I've never seen a music video that bad. I don't know what they were thinking with it, but CGI cats that throw curse breath into people's mouths and so many scenes lifted out of The Mask and even Daredevil, which had come out less than a year before. I mean, it was clearly no one who was working on this film had any idea what they were doing, and it just astounds me that they want to give the director a $100 million adaptation of Akira as his next project. So make of that what you will.
Halle Berry was hot. It's about the one plus we can say about it.
It wasn't her half the time. It was like a man, wasn't it? Dressed as a woman doing all the stunts.
Oh, was it? I didn't even know that. Well, I figured somewhere. It was somebody doing stunts. I didn't know it was a man. That's pretty funny.
Yeah,
okay.
So, the only reason that I think that this movie beat out Catwoman is because it was 3 hours long. Alexander was the worst film of the year. Additionally disappointing because Oliver Stone is so much better than that. And he clearly has no idea of how to string together a movie anymore. I tried likening the performances of taking really good cake, you know, like this amazing cake you had made for somebody with all kinds of little candles and stuff on it, and launching it off a catapult at a brick wall. Because Val Kilmer and, I mean, even Angelina Jolie, I could give her credit for a lot of things she's done, but it didn't matter if you were a good actor or a bad actor. You were left out in the desert to drown, I mean, not to drown, well, to die in this film. And none of the camera work made any sense. A lot of times he was cutting out of panning. He was cutting out of shots. The actors, the cameraman couldn't keep up with where the actors were going, and they would walk off the screen. The love affair between Jared Leto and Colin Farrell was basically, hey, you remember when we were kids and we used to wrestle? Why don't you come over to my place tonight? No, we can't, because it'll hurt the politics of the Babylonian era. And that was every scene for 3 hours.
They played up that. That's a lot of the controversy of Alexander, is that he was bisexual, and that Colin Farrell plays Alexander, for those who are wondering what we're talking about, and his best friend, Hephaestus, how do you pronounce that?
I believe it's something like
Hephaestus,
that.
Hephaestus, played by?
Jared Leto.
Jared Leto, are ambiguously best friends or lovers during the entire narrative, which has helped derail a lot of the movie, but the movie kind of sucked. Regardless.
No, trust me, it was not ambiguous. I don't know why people keep seeing this movie and calling it ambiguous. It's right in front of you, and it just goes nowhere. I mean, the only controversy that exists, I think, is for people who are offended by a movie they've never seen. And if they were to see it and see how awful it is, they'd just give up because they know nobody would care. One of the biggest offensive elements of the film, I think, is that as Stone has progressed as a filmmaker, or I wouldn't say progressed, but degressed, he's becoming increasingly obsessed with telling fictional versions of biographies through reimagining of Citizen Kane. And his constant reworking of shots and elements from Citizen Kane has become so tired and repetitive that it's obvious and it's almost like it borders on ripping off. The action scene in the movie are really bad attempt at redoing the famous action scene from Orson Welles' Chimes at Midnight, which Kenneth Branagh did better in Henry V, from what I've heard, and of course Mel Gibson did terrifically in Braveheart. I just wish more people had a better sense of film's history. They might go back in time, or not back in time, but go and find these older films, these better films, rather than wasting their time and their money on trash like Alexander.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. Now, before we go on with the films coming up in 2005, I want to remind the readers that a written version of the top 10 and 5 worst is going to be on PCR either 247 or 248, but one of the two last end-of-the-year issues of Nolan's Pop Culture Review in a column by Drew Reiber. So moving right along, what do you see for 2005?
Well, to be perfectly honest with you, I'm going to have to bring down how much I actually am looking forward to very essential elements. I hope to create maybe some kind of article that everyone can read from sometime in the future,
okay,
to get a little better sense of what's coming out.
Well, Star Wars leaps to mind.
No, not at all.
Really?
Yeah, really. I mean, I definitely believe Episode 2 was better than Episode 1, but passable is far from exciting and wonderful. I really do hope that Episode 3 comes out and is a terrific, enjoyable film, but I've ceased worrying about it. So it's not really in my huge to see list.
All right.
But I mean, heck, you know, if it turns out to be great, it'll be great. I would actually, I want to point to a lot of the weird little things that people might actually miss or not be aware of already.
All right.
Coming out next year, as well as a few larger films. Getting the larger films out of the way, I'm sure a lot of people are excited about Batman Begins.
Mm-hmm.
The restart of the Batman franchise.
Christian Bale. Yep.
I want to point out that this is the largest attempt, or the strongest attempt by Warner Brothers to get away from the formula that we've been reusing for better or worse since the 1960s TV series, which is, you know, psychos running Gotham, call up Batman to get the Batmobile and catches them. This is a return to the material of the 70s and the 80s, the more respected books on characters like Ra's al Ghul by the great Dennis O'Neill and artist Neil Adams, and of course the famous Year One run by Frank Miller and David Mazzucchelli, and little bits and pieces of some of the better Batman comics from more recent times should be popping up too, like a more recent reworking of the Scarecrow design.
So this may be the actual first time Batman's been done right.
Well, it's going to be the most multi-textural version of Batman that we've seen in live action. I do believe the cartoon series did a very good job of showing Batman in his different sort of environments. But, you know, it's a lot easier to do that when you have single episodes that exist in the world. It's going to be a real challenge to throw it all into one, you know, two-hour-long feature film. But it is called Begins, and they're already talking about three more sequels. So hopefully it's really good. We'll have a lot more films to look forward to, including, I'm hoping, a reworking of the Joker story. Now, other big films coming out, which I do not know if people are aware of, Robert Rodriguez teamed up with Frank Miller to do a direct adaptation of his graphic novel series, Sin City, which will be coming out April 1st, Batman being June 17th. Sin City's got a huge cast of Benicio del Toro, Clive Owen, Mickey Rourke, Bruce Willis. It's really should just take a look on IMDb when you get the chance. Another major film coming out is Domino, Tony Scott's next action film. Man on Fire had a typical screenplay, but its direction was very experimental. I think that he's possibly the only action director who's actually progressing the form, using subtitles and strange cuts. I really think people might be more inclined to enjoy this next film, as it's written by Richard Kelly,
mm-hmm,
who wrote, directed Donnie Darko.
Okay.
Also coming out is Terry Gilliam's next feature, which is a fantasy epic called The Brothers Grimm, with Heath Ledger and Matt Damon. Also coming out early in the year, for those of you who really like The Labyrinth and The Dark Crystal, the 80s, Hampton-produced fantasy film,
mm-hmm,
Mirror Mask, is coming out, directed by Neil Gaiman's good friend and collaborator Dave McKean, and written by Gaiman. It was a low-budget effort that was originally slated for direct-to-video, and the buzz has been so big that they're going to release it theatrically. If it does well, we'll actually see a return of the entire trend.
Fantastic. And so far, I haven't heard Fantastic Four yet.
You won't.
Don't hold a whole lot of promise for that one, huh?
Not at all. The producers of the X-Men and Daredevil franchise will not be content until they tear all the work that's been done by the original creators down. But I would recommend, however, another sequel, The Devil's Rejects.
Mm-hmm.
Those of you who saw House of Thousand Corpses, Rob Zombie is taking great effort to try and make a meaner and more, advanced film. He really believes that trying to get back to the 70s, the filmmakers who were working more off of a sort of social consciousness and reflecting on the things that sort of bother us underneath our own in our own cities and our own homes might be something more valuable in a horror
mm-hmm.
film. We'll see how that goes out. I mean, his first film was very derivative, but if he manages to get the style but create new content, it could be pretty neat. That's also going to have tons of cult movie cameos.
That sounds interesting.
Also coming out is the sequel to Dogville mm-hmm. by Lars von Trier, which is called Manderley.
Mm-hmm.
David Lynch is working on a new feature, which I believe is going to be in his Renegade style, close to Wild at Heart and Blue Velvet. I don't know if it'll be out by the end of next year, but, I mean, that's terrific news.
Is Peter Jackson's King Kong due out next year?
Yes, it is.
About a year from now, I think, yeah.
Yeah, I read about half of the original screenplay before I had to stop. He's not taking an incredibly new direction. I know that he's rewritten the script to include Kong earlier in the story,
mm-hmm.
but it really feels like he's taking us down the same route as the Phantom and the Mummy. You know, a very sort of serialized adventure take on material we've seen done 100 times. So I think he's missed the boat by a good decade.
Oh no!
It could be wrong, but we'll see.
But otherwise, it's nothing terribly original.
Yeah, I mean the characters that they've casted for are the same characters that were in the script I read, and it's just I don't know. Like I said, if you've seen The Mummy, it's going to be The Mummy with more plain action and a giant ape. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe he'll surprise us. But
well, I'm thinking. I'm also looking forward to as much as I cut down on CGI to see how he makes Kong. If he's as careful with that as he was with Golem, that should be quite an eye opener.
Yeah, we'll see, but I mean, at the same time, outside of Lord of the Rings movies, how many of his films do you really find all that engrossing? I mean, I think he's an interesting director, but I mean, he's still working off of the buzz from films that would have been huge well on their own. I mean, I'm not disrespecting the wonderful work he's done on those features, but clearly he could be doing a lot of other things rather than the remake of a film that's already been remade. I do want to point out a couple of amazing animation projects that are going to be coming out next year.
Right.
I've talked before about the animation show
mm-hmm.
that came out last year. I thought was terrific, which is produced by Don Hertzfeldt
mm-hmm.
and Mike Judge. That's going to be sometime early next year, another anthology of very original pieces. Sometimes there's even older pieces. You know, I know that they use some great 50s Disney stuff. Also from Don Hertzfeldt is a so far untitled feature film. If you guys aren't familiar with his work yet, you should really look him up. He's very terrific, complete stick figure lunacy. Mike Judge has also got his next feature film coming out next year called 3001. They may retitle it by the time it reaches theaters, but he hasn't done a film since Office Space. This one's about a man who applies to be he volunteers to be cryogenically frozen. He wakes up 1,000 years in the future, only to find that he's the smartest man on the planet because society has degenerated that far.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
Yeah, that's going to be very interesting. Another film that's going to be coming out next year. I don't know if we're going to get it right away. There's a Japanese filmmaker who debuted in the 50s and 60s. He's part of their New Wave period. He does very interesting work. He's doing a a 30s style period musical, which is very sort of, I don't know, it's got kind of like that stuff that we're familiar with from Kurosawa period films, but with very stage-bound kind of, I would almost say, you know, in terms of Chicago, where you know the characters are running around on a stage performing straight to the camera,
right.
It's going to be a, so it's like a fantasy period musical, and it's also starring Zhang Yi. I'm not sure if that's how to pronounce her name, but she was also in, you know, recently, how, was it a... House of Flying Daggers and Hero. Also been in films like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and Rush Hour 2. The last thing I really want to recommend to people, which I don't know if everyone's heard about this already, but I can't recommend it enough. George A. Romero is returning October 21st with Land of the Dead, which is the fourth entry in his Dead series. He's treating the original trilogy as a sort of encapsulated apocalypse, and this is his post-apocalypse film. This is kind of being touted as a Night or Dawn of the Dead meets Road Warrior.
Oh wow!
I already have a friend of mine has already read the screenplay as well as the screenplay for Batman Begins, saying both are terrific. And it's a real shock this movie is getting made because it's independently financed at $15 million, which is almost unheard of these days. And considering that Romero holds no rights to his earlier films, it's staggering that he can get a fourth film without the title, without any returning characters, completely based off of the idea that it's his film. So hopefully that'll really turn out well. I know the Shaun of the Dead writer and director are going to make cameo appearances in that, and I don't know, we'll see what happens.
These scripts you say you're reading, where are you getting them? Is that off the internet or something?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, if you really look, you can find just about anything. The only thing I got to warn you about is, you know, you're going to be reading something that may or may not be the finished product. And even then, I have the script for Land of the Dead. I don't want to read it because that would be, I think, offensive to the, you know, to the filmmaker. And at the same time, well, I have access to it, but, you know, and I think it would ruin the experience for me. I want to be there opening day. I want to pay for it, and I want to see it as it was intended.
Sure, experience it for the first time, for real.
Yeah, you know, but...
And it is a pretty big deal for those who have followed George Romero for 30 years and loved all the Night of the Living Dead films and the series sequels and see how much it's been riffed off to have Romero return in this form is very exciting.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because the film got made because of the runaway success of 28 Days Later, which is a complete rehash of his work, and he refuses to criticize 28 Days Later because he feels that he's really indebted to that film.
It's just irony piles on top of irony, huh?
Yeah, pretty much.
Before that, the zombie genre was kind of dead until 28 Days Later came out, which owes a lot to Night of the Living Dead, which enables Night of the Living Dead to continue as Land of the Dead. Boy, just irony on top of irony.
Well, I mean, I just hope that there's still some real zombie fans out there by the time the film reaches theaters. The only downside is that in order to get the negative pickup deal that and with the financiers, people finance the film, Universal distributing it, they have to offer a rated R cut for theatrical distribution, which means it will be tremendously cut down from what will eventually reach home video, which, you know, I'm sure will be unrated. So, I mean, George Romero will get to shoot what he wants to shoot, but the film that will come out in theaters will be, you know, of course, minded by him, but it will be somewhat shorter than what we're probably used to seeing. But I imagine it'll still be a far better film than, you know, the Resident Evil features and stuff like that.
Well, a lot to look forward to in 2005. Drew, thanks so much for being on the World of Nolan Radio.
Thanks, Nolan.